I still haven't figured out, since they changed the website around, how to get to the, what is it, web controls or whatever?
Yeah,
so I can see who's on the call.
If you go to menu, then choose meeting wall. Okay. And then meeting wall will allow you to choose web controls. Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. So, since we are now recording, this is the 9/11 Truth Teleconference for the 29th of March, 2017. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis, facilitating, and Greg McKee, secretary. Greg, you want to call the roll?
Okay. I'll read who I have, and then we'll see if I've missed anybody. I have Barry Zwicker, Charles Ewing Smith, Cheryl Curtis, Ken Freeland, David Cole, Frank Tolopko, John O'Malley, Michael Cook, and I think that's everybody except the Boston people.
No, you got to go to page two. Peter Ketchum is also all with us, okay?
Okay, I switched to two. Oh, there, yes. See him now.
Okay, so yeah, Boston 9/11 Truth has a crowd tonight, and so we'll ask them to unmute star six and tell us who all is there if they want to get the names on the roster. So Boston 9/11 Truth, press star six, please, and we'll see who's with you. Boston 9/11 Truth, star six, please. I may try to unmute you anyway. Yeah, you're unmuted. So Boston 9/11 Truth, you guys want to tell us who's with you?
Yeah, we have Barton, Bruce,
okay.
And we have Chris Bergier, Al Magaletta, Michael Carey, Al Rubin, Jane Milliken, Rachel Warden, Richard Krishnick, and David Rold.
Fantastic. And you know what? Your background noise went away for the time being, so maybe we won't have to ask you to mute again. Let's see how long
there was. Sorry, there was a name right between Rachel and David that I didn't have it. I didn't write down fast enough.
Richard Krishnick.
Krishnick. Okay, great. And also the Chris between right after Barton, you mentioned Chris. Could you spell the last name for me?
B E R G I E R.
Craig, you're echoing.
Okay, I don't know why. I can hear it.
Why there's an echo, you mean?
Yeah.
I think the echo is on the Boston Truth line. It's coming through their
so,
thing. So we'll have to ask.
Okay, is this better? Is that any better?
Yes, it is. Is mine not echoing?
Yep.
Yeah, it's Chris Bergier. B-E-R-I-E-R.
B-E-R, like...
B-E-R-G-I-E-R. Bergier.
Right, at the beginning, is it like B like Bob or D like Doug?
B like Bob.
Okay, so B-E-R-G-I-E-R.
Yep.
Got it. Chris. Okay. Got it.
Jim,
I'm echoing again.
So, you want me to read them over one time and make sure we got to
read them over again? Okay. Barry Zwicker, Charles Ewing Smith, Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis, Barton Bruce, Chris Bergier, Al Magaletta, Michael Carey, Al Rubin, Jane Milliken, Rachel Warden, David Rold, Richard Krushnick, Dan Hennen, David Cole, I don't know if I said that, Dick Attlee, Frank Tolopko, James Hufford, John O'Malley, Michael Cook, and Peter Ketchum. Did I get everybody?
Unfortunately, I didn't hear Kevin Barrett's name mentioned. Did anybody else?
No, and I emailed him right before this to remind him and give him the phone number, but...
Well, you want to drop off and call him up real quick? Can you do that?
Well, He doesn't have it. He uses. I guess I can try. He uses Skype. Let me see if I can get him on that then. And okay, I'll be right back.
Okay. So the next thing on the agenda then would be the approval of the minutes from the previous teleconference as circulated by Craig. Any objection to approving the minutes or any amendments for the minutes? Okay, hearing none, then the minutes will be approved, and we'll consider tonight's agenda, which will probably have to be shuffled a little bit if Kevin doesn't show up pretty quickly. But other than that, are there any amendments to tonight's agenda? Okay, then we'll adopt the draft agenda and go from there. Let's see, is Bill Volt here? Huh. Oh my gosh. We got a bunch of no-shows tonight. That's unusual. Well, maybe he'll come later and he can do his bit later. And see, Cheryl can't do her thing and she's not here.
Ken, can you speak louder? Ken, can you speak louder?
Does this help? Does that help?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll hold the microphone closer. All right, so we are going to have to wait for Cheryl to come back, I think, before we do anything. So hopefully it won't take her very long, and you can just chatter in the meantime. Anything you want to talk about? Just to let you all know, Peter Ketchum, who's on our call again tonight, will be our special guest next month. When in anticipation of Whistleblower Appreciation Month, Kevin will give us a pretty nice overview of his situation, you know, where he's coming from with NIST and what's going on with his sort of criticism of the NIST report. So that will be something to look forward to next month. You want to say anything by way of teasing that, Peter?
Well, I hope to, give you a presentation that you'll find interesting. At this point, I'm not really sure if I'm going to write up something formal, like a little speech, or whether you'd be more interested in just sort of a casual chit-chat.
It's entirely up to you, Peter. Whatever you feel comfortable with doing, you know. And then just let me know how many minutes you want to speak for, and then we'll do Q&A when you're done.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think we all are.
Yeah, for sure.
You're definitely a man of the moment for a lot of us, and we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Okay, well, very good.
So what about the limit Airtel requested for a change in rules?
Well, I wanted to wait, give Cheryl a chance to input on that, too, so I'll just kind of wait. But let me get started with that, since she's already familiar with the item. Starting back, I think it was in May of 2011, the teleconference decided that the listserv participation, everybody probably doesn't know that we have this listserv, but it is there available for anybody who participates in the teleconference. It's a discussion listserv for whatever purposes people use it for in between teleconferences, you know, to discuss different matters and so forth. No decisions are made there or anything like that, but it's a place to discuss items further or, you know, ancillary items and so forth. Anyway, the teleconference decided in May of 2011 that only people who were active on the teleconference should participate in the listserv, that it was, you know, ancillary to the teleconference and not the other way around. And so I've been keeping up with that for a while, and then, you know, got kind of slack because it does, you know, take time and effort. And I realized at the beginning of the year that some moss had grown around the rock, and there were some people on the listserv that hadn't been on the teleconference for quite some time. So following a suggestion from Cheryl, I just sent a notification to the listserv mentioning the names of the people who needed to show up at the teleconference if they didn't want to be unsubscribed from the listserv. And there were about six of them. Five of them neither responded nor showed up, and they were summarily removed from the listserv. But Lynn Ertel wrote a letter, which I will read to you. It's in entirety. It's very short. And unfortunately, reading it a second time, I realize there's some ambiguity here. But let me read it, and then you can help me decipher it. It says, please maintain me on the listserv for the regular deep state teleconferences. Scheduling conflicts, I can't usually participate in the live teleconference. However, I always download and listen to the recorded version a day or two later, and I would hope to continue doing that. Thanks, Lynn Ertel. Okay, so my original thought on receiving this was that she was asking to still be kept on the listserv. But the more I look at this, the more I realize that she might be just asking to be kept on the on our mailing list, and she's using the wrong word. I don't know, okay? But assuming that she wants to be kept on the teleconference despite the fact that she hasn't been on the that she wants to be on the listserv despite the fact that she hasn't been on the teleconference in I think the past year, okay, I thought I should bring it back for consideration. It may be that there's a confusion of terminology here and that's all that's going on. But otherwise, she does seem to be asking for an exception to the rule, and that's a decision that I think needs to be made here, if it's made at all. So it's open for discussion what people think about that idea.
I'm curious as to how, of the five other people who were summarily dismissed, were any of them regular participants in the discussion list?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should mention that the answer to that is no, they were not. But I should mention that the active participation in the teleconference was defined during that May 11th decision as being not missing more than three consecutive teleconferences, okay? Mm-hmm. And so, of course, Lynn is, like I say, I don't think she's been there for the last year, for a whole year on the teleconference. But Lynn herself is an active participant in the listserv, but not on the teleconference, okay?
Which differentiates her from the others.
Yes, yes. For what that's worth, but again, we have to, bear in mind the nature of the original decision that requires some participation in the teleconference in order to be on the listserv. So there's the dilemma.
I mean, some of the factors, at least to me, that weigh in are, much as I disagree with her a lot when she's discussing things on the discussion list, she certainly brings a lot of information and perspectives to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can certainly sympathize with scheduling issues. You know, if somebody has something that's always scheduled for Wednesday evening, and it's difficult to, avoid missing that, that would be a problem if somebody actually has a legitimate thing. You might communicate with her more in private to see what the problem is. But
yeah, well, I have tried to reach her by phone. I've been unsuccessful.
This is James Hufford. I think we should lean toward keeping her on the listserv. First of all, she differentiates herself from the others because she made the request. That's one thing. So it does matter to her, and I think it matters to us because there aren't all that many people who are active on the listserv, and we should tend to, if we can, include anyone who wants to participate, who just sort of is part of the group, and I'm not saying we want to fill it with trolls or anything like that, but someone we know and someone who has participated a long time, I think we should give favorable consideration to.
Okay, anybody else? Any other thoughts on this?
Hello?
Who?
Mike Cook, can you hear me?
Yeah, Mike, go ahead, Mike.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I'm somebody who can certainly sympathize with anybody that has scheduling problems. Sometimes my availability for other things is zero, and sometimes I've got a lot of time, so I kind of ebb and flow as what I can participate in. I didn't know about the listserv, or if I did, I forgot. It's a nice alternative to being able to make the calls.
Well, it's not an alternative.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to comment on that. Who just said that?
This is Dick.
Yeah, Dick. Yeah, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's not an alternative in the sense that you get kicked off if you're not part of the teleconference call. The two go together.
Well, yeah, in other words, it's not designed to be an alternative, okay? I mean, that was pretty clearly the decision of the teleconference 5 years ago. It's not supposed to be seen as something aside from the teleconference. It's a place where the people who are on the teleconference have to communicate, you know, in the interstices, but it's not meant to be a separate community, I guess you could say. That's my understanding from the decision.
So you have been unable to get hold of her by phone, although you have a phone number for her?
Yes.
In the world of paranoia, the only reason I'd be curious about that is what if she doesn't want to be heard or spoken on the conference call and she doesn't want to answer her phone, that's the only thing that seems a little little odd to me. I mean, unless she's deaf or has some other problem with it, that's a little puzzling.
Yeah, if I could comment on what Mike Cook said, I do agree with what he said, and I certainly think that from time to time, you know, we have to say, well, you know, somebody could have, you know, scheduling problems that would cause them to miss the 3-month rule at some point or another. But that would be with the understanding that there would be some effort made over time to show up at least once in a while, you know, and
Hello, this is Richard in Boston. The 9 of us here are taking our meeting time for this call, and we'd appreciate it if housekeeping could be kept to a less of a time-consuming item.
Well, we're almost done with this issue, but it is something that we have to take care of, unfortunately. It's part of the teleconference's responsibility, but we're almost done with it, and then we'll get on to other things.
And the rest of the agenda isn't possible at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have to wait for Cheryl to return before we can continue.
I'm back on the call, and I cannot reach him via Skype, so I sent him another email and asked if, you know, I gave him the call-in number again, but he doesn't have a phone. He goes through Skype, so I don't know how else to reach him.
He does have a phone, and I have his number. Unfortunately, it's in the other room. If you want to hang on for a minute,
sure,
I can get it.
Sure.
I'll be right back.
Okay, well, let's see if we can bring this to a close. I was just going to comment very quickly on what Mike Cook said. Oh, I think I did. I think I made my comment.
Could I just interrupt? It's Barry in Toronto. I have Kevin Barrett's phone number here.
Oh, you do? Great.
Yeah,
it's
area code 608. It's area code 608-583-2132.
Great. I'll call him and I'll get back on the line. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure.
Hurry up, Cheryl. Thank you. All right. So, does anybody else want to make a comment before we, take a poll on this and see what we want to do with it?
Yeah, I'd like to make an amendment.
Okay, go ahead.
Conditional on her, this is Dick, conditional on her talking to you on the phone, just to make sure she isn't the guy who's been spinning a lot of stories, it would be useful to know that she is real and that we have no problem with her being on the teleconference.
I should mention on her behalf, Dick, that many, many moons ago I did reach her by phone for another reason, so I do know that she exists. Okay.
I'll withdraw the suggestion.
Well, not necessarily, because things could change, but right now when I call I get a strange tone. It just doesn't answer and it goes into something else. I don't know what's going on there. I mean, not have the right number anymore.
Okay, I'm back, and his telephone number, which worked
thank
the
you,
last
you,
time I
you.
Tried it.
Yeah, Barry.
Area 608-583-2132.
Okay, thank you. Cheryl already was given it while you were gone by Barry, who also happened to have it. Thank you.
I left a message for him there. That's his landline at his house, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And I heard his voice on the leave a message. That's all.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, this is not the first time this has happened with Kevin. We had two other instances last over a year ago where he was going to come on and speak to the issue of Fetzer and the Veterans Today issue, and he didn't show both times. So I guess it's a chronic problem. But he was here last time. When he and his compatriots spoke on that one issue. So,
can I interrupt? This is Cheryl.
Yeah.
I connected with Kevin. Thank you for that phone number. And he's lost track of time in the garden, and he's going to get on in about a minute. So
great. All right, thank you. So I guess we're ready to take a vote on this. Let's see. All in favor of granting an exception for Lynn Ertel to stay on the teleconference, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Okay, sorry. All opposed, say nay. All right, well, I guess then she'll be allowed to stay on it, assuming that is what she's really asking here, because if it isn't, I'm going to take her off, okay? If she really just meant that she only wanted to be on the mailing list, but if she had other intentions, then we'll let her stay on. Okay. Okay. So, I guess we're just waiting for Kevin.
Yes, I'm here.
Kevin,
he's on. Yeah.
Ah, welcome, Kevin. Okay. Well. All right. So the first item on our agenda tonight will be Kevin Durant, and to introduce him, that will be Cheryl.
Okay.
Hey, Cheryl.
Yeah, and I know he doesn't need an introduction with all of us, but I'll do one anyway. Kevin Barrett is an American Muslim and a PhD Islamic studies scholar. He's one of America's best-known critics of the war on terror. He has authored and edited several books, including Another French False Flag in 2016, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, 2015, and Questioning the War on Terror, 2009. Dr. Barrett has appeared many times on Fox, CNN, PBS, and other broadcast outlets, and inspired feature stories and op-eds in the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, the Chicago Tribune, and other mainstream publications. He's a former professor of French, Arabic, Islamic studies, humanities, and other subjects at colleges and universities in Paris, San Francisco, Bay Area, and Wisconsin. And he currently works as a talk radio host. He's the editor of at Veterans Today and a pundit at Press TV, Russia Today, and Al Etasia, I hope I'm saying that right, and other international channels. His website is truthjihad.com. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be back with all of you. And I'm very sorry I was working on my garden, and I thought it was still mid-afternoon. I'm trying to save my baby lettuce plants that are about to get flattened by a hard rain. So, anyway.
So, if you want to tell us about your recent trip to Iran, that would really be of interest to all of us, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah. This was my fourth trip to Iran, and I've always gone for conferences of various kinds. And this was a conference called, it was the, was it sixth conference in support of the Palestinian Intifada. So that was a great name to use on Homeland Security on the way back to the U.S., of course. and it was interesting. You know, I've always done 9/11 related presentations in all of my previous trips. But this time, I wasn't really presenting. There were much more illustrious people than me at this conference. I think there were people from 80 countries, and most of those sent people from their parliaments, or I should say people from their parliaments chose to go. They weren't always sent by the government. And then there were a number of speakers of parliaments, including from North Korea and where else, a number of other countries. So there were a lot of international heavy hitters there. And I think Iran is sort of proud of being able to host this kind of conference. No other country probably ever could, because they're independent enough to be able to clearly and cleanly side with the Palestinians.
So that's something I appreciate about Iran, is that as a genuinely independent Middle Eastern country, Muslim majority, and the product of an Islamic revolution that was very much aimed at freeing them from imperialism and colonialism, they are in a position to take these kinds of controversial stance by supporting Palestine in the way that almost the entire population of the Middle East would wish to do, but in most cases their governments can't do that because of various carrots and sticks. And this is also the reason that Iran is able to support 9/11 Truth. There's no other country in the Middle East, with the brief exception of Egypt under President Morsi, who was quickly overthrown, that's been able to have a leader who supports 9/11 Truth, that can, you know, openly host conferences and, you know, have an international channel, in this case Press TV, that consistently is open to 9/11 Truth. Even Russia Today, which used to be, no longer will cover 9/11 Truth-related topics. So for all of these reasons, I'm really happy that there is this, you know, one Middle Eastern country that's independent and that has a history of trying to take a principled stand in opposing oppression, and in particular, you know, oppression from the big imperial colonial powers. So it was great to be there. I had a lot of, you know, ran into a lot of friends over there. Allison Weir and Tony Hall are two of them. Michael Jones, a conservative Catholic that I got to know the first time I was in Iran, was there. And he's always a lot of fun. We don't always agree on everything. So there are also various new people that I hadn't met before. Oh, and Sheikh Imran Hossein, who is one of the Islamic world's leading intellectuals, you know, thinking about politics and so on, was there as well. And you know, he's one of the very few traditional Muslim scholars that I really admire. And he was an early 9/11 Truth supporter. He spoke out very strongly virtually from the day it happened.
Had Gene joining.
So I always feel like I've kind of, you know, moved into a freer atmosphere when I go to these conferences in Iran. They're a lot like I wish academic conferences were here in the U.S. or really anywhere else, open to the kinds of perspectives of people who try to speak truth to power in a very forthright way. And I appreciate that the folks who organized this conference, it was an Iranian NGO, although I think they had government support for the Palestine conference, and then there was a sort of a mini conference within that, consisting of those of us from various other countries who were coming because we're sort of noted dissidents or free thinkers, as they call us, from around the world. So there's a, you know, a couple of people who've been involved with all of these conferences I've been to, a fellow named Montezemi and Hamid Reshnavi are sort of the two that I know the best. And then I also got to meet another friend of mine over there who's been a 9/11 Truth supporter from way back, Arash Daryabhandari, who's also kind of a Shia theologian. He's actually from a Christian Iranian background, and he converted to Shia Islam and has been cranking out a lot of books recently. So it was great. It wasn't really this time focused on 9/11 Truth. It was focused on Palestine, and I did raise the issue there with various people that 9/11 Truth and false flags are a major part of that issue, and that in fact, you know, probably a leading motive behind 9/11 was to give Israel carte blanche to attack Palestinians and to continue to expand its borders, and to save it from bankruptcy, since they, you know, they invested in anti-terror startups during the year before 9/11, and so on and so forth. So I always try to push that when I'm hanging out with Palestinian activists, and I, you know, I have some success, but not as much as I would like. And then the other sort of 9/11 issue I brought up over there was the collapse of the high rise. When was that? Like about 3 months ago, there was a nearly 20-story high-rise that collapsed in Tehran. Looked exactly like the 9/11 collapses, so-called collapses. Sounds of explosions, molten steel comes down at free fall into its footprint. You know, it looked like another illegal controlled demolition, which is what Architects and Engineers is saying it was. So I tried to bring that up as well and urged the people I know over there to try and take action on that. So that's kind of the short version of what I was doing over there. And so if people want to ask questions, that might I might be able to give you information that you're especially interested in if we do it that way.
Okay. Well, that being the case, then let's go into our Q&A mode, which will take just a second here. We're now in Q&A mode, and we are going to unmute Kevin so he can have a microphone. And anybody else who would like to ask a question or make a comment can do so by pressing star 6 at this point, and you'll automatically go into the queue, and we'll call on you in order. Okay? And it looks like we're ready with Barry Zwicker. Go ahead, Barry.
Oh, yeah, Barry Zwicker here. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Barry. Good to hear you.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm interested. I saw the video, I guess lots of us did, about the collapse of that building. And I was trying it, and what you said exactly, I think, equates with what those of the rest of us saw about the building. It just looked classic. And I was wondering if you learned anything more about who might do that and what their motives might be, if indeed it was engineered destruction.
Right. Well, the building, it was called the Plasco Building. And I guess it was under 20 stories, closer to 15, built around 1960. And the people I talked to over there, my friends who were hip to 9/11, all agreed with me that it was very suspicious. And they were, you know, concerned that the government there may not be wanting to sort of jump on it and do a big investigation and make a scandal of it. But I learned over there some more things that I hadn't heard from architects and engineers, such as the molten steel or molten metal, I don't know, iron or whatever, sounds of explosions, et cetera, et cetera. And it also appears that right after this building collapsed or exploded or whatever, the sort of opposition propaganda TV stations based in Los Angeles, which are very, very well financed by basically U.S. and Zionist sources and which beam American and Zionist propaganda at Iran 24/7, 365, you know, try to hit them up with a lot of, you know, very flashy stuff to make it look like life in Los Angeles is great. And then they also, you know, try to sort of undercut the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic ethos, and so on. So there's this huge propaganda media thing broadcasting in Persian, mainly based in Los Angeles and run by friends of the Shah and that whole community that left after the revolution. And instantly after that building collapse, this propaganda media was putting out very, very slick and very, you know, emotionally oriented kinds of stuff, a lot like we got after 9/11. About, you know, highlighting the firefighters. I think there were like 16 firefighters and 10 people that died. And so those people were being eulogized in a very, very slick kind of way. And it was all choreographed, like the entire sort of, you know, out of Iran, you know, media, the sort of anti-Iranian government media was just blasting nothing but this kind of propaganda, this heartthrob firefighter, you know, human sacrifice propaganda, basically, a lot like we got after 9/11 with the victims, the firefighters, and this sort of thing. It's the same kind of propaganda that we get about our troops, our slain troops, the guy who died in Yemen that Trump was talking about. You know, this sort of thing, is basically geared towards this element of human nature that is, there's a whole human sacrifice complex in our deep unconscious, as Rene Girard showed. So anyway, they were broadcasting that kind of propaganda instantly after the collapse. So between that and the molten steel and the sounds of explosions and the free fall and the symmetry, basically all of those 10 features that David Ray Griffin talked about with 9/11 that have only happened with the three high-rises on 9/11 and have never, ever happened anywhere else on Earth, these exclusive features of controlled demolitions, well, most of those were also present at this Plasco building collapse. So my friends over there are kind of the hardcore truthers, and they know about 9/11. They're very aware of 9/11. Unfortunately, most of Iran doesn't know that much about 9/11. You know, it happened somewhere else. It's like we probably, you know, the average American wouldn't know much about the Plasco building collapse, or the average American wouldn't know that 19,000 Iranian civilians have been killed by U.S.-supported terrorists bombing mosques and markets and things like that in Iran since the revolution. And, you know, so we don't pay that much attention to what's going on outside our borders. And the Iranians are, unfortunately, a little bit like that. They're, they kind of basically know that there are these questions about 9/11 and so on, but they don't know any of the details, especially the sort of architects and engineers' details about the high-rise building collapses. So for that reason, my friends who understand this are kind of frustrated because, you know, they realize that one motive here could be that the 9/11 perps could do this, and now they can say, "Ha, see, there's another building collapse like 9/11. Therefore, those 10 exclusive characteristics that David Ray Griffin talked about are not exclusive anymore. This can happen." So that would be one possible motive. And then again, there's this wave of terrorism targeting Iranians. You know, the Israelis shoot and kill an Iranian scientist every so often. There's this whole gallery of their pictures in the hotel there, of all of these bright young scientists that have been murdered in Mossad hits, and the Mujahideen al-Khalq, this terror group. It's like a Marxist-Leninist terror group supported by the U.S., previously supported by Saddam Hussein, has killed a high percentage of those. I think 19,000 people killed in terrorism since the revolution. So there's a terrorism problem in Iran, and they kind of have it under control now. You know, they didn't so much back during the early days after the revolution when their top government leaders, you know, about half of their main government leaders were murdered by these U.S.-supported terrorists. But it's more under control now than it was, and they don't want to give the impression to their people that they don't have things under control. So there is a kind of a cover-your-ass thing going over there. And the people I talked to suggested that this could be terrorism. It could be by essentially the same people that did 9/11, which means a sort of, Mossad Gladio B or something along those lines. And it could be, it could also have been partly because the building itself was like the Twin Towers, a kind of a white elephant at this point. So there might be an insurance angle there as well. So it could be sort of anti-Iran terrorism, could be sending a message, there could be an insurance angle. And it maybe could be even something, to point to a counterexample to the 9/11 controlled demolition theory.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Before we go to our next questioner, we have a caller who just joined about 10 minutes ago on the 724 number. Who is that?
Gene Laratonda from Pittsburgh.
Did you catch it, Craig?
Hello, I don't know if that Gene Laratonda from Pittsburgh.
Yes, sorry, Ken, I was muted there, but yes, I did get that.
Okay, good. I don't know if you got it, Cheryl, could you write his name in, because I can't understand it, but okay, we think we can proceed. Okay, so we'll go to the next questioner. That would be, I think, Michael Cook. No, I'm sorry, it's Dick Atley.
Hi, you sort of buzzed through the issue of homeland security, but it's certainly an interesting question, given that you were flying from Iran. What happened going and coming?
Well, yeah, I was expecting something more interesting than what actually happened. And it's funny, this 4 trips to Iran, you'd think that I would be actually detained after at least one of them and seriously questioned, like what happened to me coming back from Europe five, six years ago. I did a tour of Europe, Germany, Netherlands, and Belgium, speaking to Turkish exile communities. And when I came back, my traveling companion, Professor Suleyman Kurder of University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I were held up for several hours. We were not allowed to use the bathroom. We were not allowed to make a cell phone call to tell his son, who'd come to pick us up at the airport, what had happened. So we were kept incommunicado for several hours. And then finally questioned. So that was the one time I came back from abroad that you know, there's a kind of a serious questioning. It actually turned out okay, and the guy questioning us turned out to be, like, really open to the 9/11 truth thing, and I gave him my books and signed them and gave him DVDs. I think he was Muslim, actually. So these Iran trips, however, I've had easy reentries all four times, and so go figure. I must be not doing something right. But this time, I think the guy, the Homeland Security guy, said, "You know, so where were you? Did you go anywhere besides Germany?" As I was coming through Germany, I said, "Yeah, Iran." "Oh, what were you doing in Iran?" I said, "I was at the conference in support of the Palestinian Intifada." "So go ahead, flag me." And you know, kind of humorously, and he started laughing and said, "Welcome home." That's it. And this guy was also another sort of, you know, more sort of ethnic-looking person, you know, not pure white American, like the guy who had ended up questioning me in a very friendly way after that long wait after coming back from Europe. So I'm noticing that these Homeland Security people look, you know, that guy was Muslim, and this guy this time may have been, I don't know, but he looked like an immigrant. He looked like somebody that Trump probably wouldn't like. So, you know, I don't know if Trump's dream of ethnically cleansing America is really going to work. And if Homeland Security is all people who are like, you know, "Oh, the Palestinian Intifada Conference, right on."
You know? The human resources people must be screwed up.
Yeah, they're not,
not hiring,
you know, they don't have
people.
Steve Bannon putting racists in charge yet.
Thanks.
Okay. And last is Michael Cook. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Back to the Plasco building. I came across something that looked like it might be similar to 9/11, and possibly the Iranian government was in on it as a urban renewal. They had tried to get the building torn down, and there was a big legal fight, and the people living there didn't want to leave, and that kind of thing. And that really discouraged me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know anything about that angle, Kevin.
No, I actually hadn't heard anything about that, but it wouldn't completely surprise me. You know, the Iranian government is not, it doesn't really speak with one voice. You know, over here we get the impression, you know, where the propaganda is that it's sort of a theocracy run by the supreme leader and, you know, nothing else really matters over there. But actually, that's not at all true. It's extremely pluralistic, and there are different factions, you know, even within sort of the Shia theocracy side of things, with the mullahs and so on, they're totally different schools of thought. And I guess the supreme leader, when he wants something done, it's not that likely to get done. As I learned on this trip, heard some stories about how, you know, he was giving these direct orders to on this and that subject, and they weren't being carried out. There are different factions, and, you know, Rafsanjani, that just died recently, was a billionaire, kind of a representative of the slick and oily side of power in Iran. And it's very possible that some faction there could have done something like this, just like, you know, we had a faction here in the U.S. that did 9/11. And, you know, one would hope that the better side of their government would get on it. And, you know, I've heard some sort of rumors that they are. I've heard, you know, so there might be some kind of internal political struggle coming up over this.
10-4, thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cheryl, you want to say something?
Yeah, Kevin, I wanted to ask you, did they come up with any new ways of supporting the Palestinians or any ways that they thought were being, you know, helpful and working?
That's a good question. You know, there was a lot of rhetoric, and I guess the overall theme that was sounded by the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who gave the keynote speech, was that, you know, very, very strong resistance is the only way to go, because the Zionists will not negotiate in good faith. And so, you know, just being set for the long haul and supporting the military resistance groups, you know, they were all there, you know, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and, of course, Hezbollah, you know, all sent high-level representatives to this conference. And the view of the Supreme Leader, as well as probably, I guess, you know, maybe half of the attendees would be my guess, would be that there's really no negotiating with the Zionists. They're committed to their expansionist agenda and their ethnic cleansing agenda, and it's just getting worse. The Jewish population of Israel is becoming more and more fanatical and racist all the time. So they won't give anything, you know, unless there's a way to take it, and the only way to take it is to have power against them that ultimately they'll have to, you know, they'll have to negotiate it because there's a power that can stand up to them. So that's, you know, and that's one of the things you'll hear in Iran that you'd never hear in the U.S. I mean, that would be called supporting terrorism if anybody took that position here.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, I'd like to just, you know, throw in a little comment that's off this subject, but one that I really want to make public. You know, your show with Tony Hall, gets better every week. And I really hope that folks will turn into False Flag Radio Weekly News. They haven't listened to it before. You can get it through nolivesradio.org. And give it a listen, because that's the best way that I know to keep up with what's happening in current events from a false flag or deep state perspective. But one thing I wanted to ask you about that, Kevin, is there doesn't seem to be any way to support you directly on that show. I mean, I do support No Lies Radio, but I guess that's really the only way to support that particular show, right?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. You just gave me a great opportunity to plug this. We're actually going to start a system, basically a GoFundMe for each show, because I'm swamped right now. I'm way behind on this translation of a 500-page scholarly book I'm in the middle of. Should have had it done in January. And False Flag Weekly News takes up a fair bit of my time preparing for it, you know, reading all the news stories and so on. So I just told those guys, you know, both of those guys do have other incomes, and I don't. So I'm, you know, I have a lot of ways to earn very poor hourly wages doing all sorts of stuff like translation. But working for free, you know, 10, 15, 20 hours a week on Folks Like Weekly News has kind of reached the end of its tether. So I told these guys, you know, they were suggested this, and we came up with a plan to do a GoFundMe for each episode. And so basically we're going to start that. I'm going to announce that this Friday.
Good
deal.
And
then after that, we'll have a special GoFundMe, you know, targeting to, you know, raise at least $200 a week. The $200 will keep me doing it. So if we get $200 bucks by Monday, I'll be there on Friday. If not, I mean, I won't be. So there will be a way to support False Flag Weekly News.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that, because I think I understand that you do need income, of course, and that a lot of work goes into that show, because it shows, you know. So good luck. I hope that the new plan brings in the income that you need to keep it rolling, because it's extremely important for the truth community. Okay. Kevin, thanks for joining us tonight. You're welcome, of course, to stay on, but we need to move on to our next agenda item now. Is Bill Walt on the call? Oh, let's see. Let's get out of Q&A mode.
I have family commitments, so thank you.
Sure.
All.
And take care of your lettuce, too. Don't forget.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Right.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Can you hear me? It's Barb. I'm on the call.
Oh, Barb, good. Glad you could make it.
Yeah, I came on about 5:30, but you couldn't hear me saying so.
Okay, good deal. Yeah, because we're just about to get to the item that you want to participate in, so that's good. So, but Bill Wilt is not here, is that correct? There's no Bill Wilt on the call, right? All right, well, we're just going to drop that item, because that's 2 months in a row we've carried it, and Bill hasn't been able to show up for it or to present. So we're just going to drop that if there's no objection. Okay, so let's move on now to our last formal item here, and that is the idea came from Cheryl first, but Barbara also has a contribution to make to it, and this is regarding an idea for a 9/11 Truth Museum. So I'll let Cheryl tell you all about that, and then we'll give Barbara a shot at the same question, the same subject. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay. So, yeah, you know, the powers that be, they create these museums to lock in and reinforce their lies of the official story of 9/11 and other events. So I think that we need to counteract with our own museum. And I know that that feels like a really big undertaking. So I just gave it some thought, and I guess I'm hoping for a lot of feedback from you all on what you think. And so I'll go through what I've come up with. I'd like to see some kind of a museum, like a SCADS museum, you know, State Crimes Against Democracy, where we included 9/11 was a big part of it, but we had we could have an assassinations room and other false flag rooms besides 9/11, you know, a room on the global war on terror, a whistleblower room. And instead of like having a gift shop, we could have a gift of knowledge shop and sell books and videos and things to keep funding the building and and everything. And, you know, the admission, once we get it going, would hopefully cover the costs. We could have a banned book room, and I'd like to see something that had like a research room with a library, with a reading room, and perhaps an auditorium in this for events so that, you know, they can't cancel events on us for people that, you know, some people don't like and that kind of thing. And that would also bring in some additional, you know, funds. And we could possibly work with other groups to create this, like the people in the JFK, you know, Oklahoma City. And even, you know, I'm thinking even with the vaccines, that to me is some sort of a, you know, it's a SCADS kind of thing with our Center for Disease Control involved in that. So, and then I thought we'd also have to leave one room for future SCADS because we know they're going to happen. And those are just some of my own thoughts. And I started researching this, and I looked at, there's a lot online about how to create a museum and start a museum, which really surprised me. But so to have like a 9,000 square foot building, somebody estimated that it would cost roughly $1.8 million to build this. And so I'm thinking it might cost a little more than that, but because I don't know how old that was. But I think that in order to get this started, we would need like an advisory board or, you know, a committee to work on it. And I think if we did like some kind of funding online to get started, there's some really wealthy people in the 9/11 truth movement. Maybe they would help us out. And if we could get some paid employees to actually, with some knowledge about maybe museums even, that to help us out with this and be working on it, you know, as their main job. And so I went on. There's a website called Museum Planning, museumplanner.org, that tells you how to start a museum. And one of the things they did is you have to visit 20 museums before you start your own and get an idea of, you know, learn all you can about it. There's a book out called Starting Right, A Basic Guide to Museum Planning. And then there's also a book called The National Standards and Best Practices for U.S. Museums, which costs $14.95. And so the first step, they said, was to learn about museums, so, you know, visit the 20 of them, identify your purpose and need and resources, like have a solid vision, and then you establish your museum. You have to learn about the legal aspects, the tax obligations and that. And then there was a whole bunch of stuff on how to sustain your museum day-to-day, you know, hiring staff, keeping it financially viable. And there's also an American Alliance of Museums that had a lot of information about how to do a museum. So, you know, I think it's a big undertaking, and I don't know what people think, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So, and maybe Barbara wants to go next before. I don't know how you want to do that. But
Barbara had requested the opportunity to give some input on this too. So go ahead, Barbara.
Okay. I Cheryl and I had a phone conversation before our teleconference call tonight. And there's no question in my mind, but this idea is in the zeitgeist. It's definitely like an idea whose time has come. People should know that, you know, I did the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour 2 years ago. I just went on YouTube. It has has almost 136,000 views on the main one alone. And if you scroll down on the thumbnails on the right of related YouTubes, then you get to official ones like the 9/11 Memorial Museum at Ground Zero. It has fewer than that, only 122,000. Scroll down a little bit more inside the 9/11 Memorial Museum. These are pushing the official story and lie there only about 31,000. So the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour, of course, that's a virtual version that I did with Bonnie Faulkner as the so-called co-narrator and co-guide. It's really right at the top. So we're our 9/11 truth movement has made a big inroads into the truth, at least in these related related videos that are online. I would like people to know that before I even did the 9/11 Museum Virtual Walking Tour, which was announced by Richard Gage at his Ground Zero press conference at the 2015, I believe, no, 2014, on September 11th, 2014, so it's now been almost 2.5 years, that before I even did that, I called up Les Jamison, and Les Jamison and I went back and forth for quite a while on the idea for a physical museum, as well as for a virtual 9/11 museum, or virtual false flag museum, or virtual SCAD museum. And this 9/11 museum virtual walking tour, which has been extremely successful online, was kind of a test case for that. So it would take an awfully lot of money to raise the funds and a lot of time compared to doing a virtual version of what we want to do in bricks and mortars, which I think should be our goal, absolutely. But in order to design the bricks and mortars one, you almost need to do the virtual one anyway. Like in you can hire people for not too much money who are experts in doing three-dimensional building walkthroughs, where you can populate, this is the word they use, you can populate each room or exhibit area with what you think you would want in the Bricks and Mortars Museum. And those of us who are working on creating the Bricks and Mortars one eventually can actually work out the bugs and decide what we want in the virtual version. So I think we can have the best of both worlds. So that's my input. And in addition, Cheryl knows this, but she didn't mention it yet. One of the reasons I know it's in the zeitgeist is that, believe it or not, just before I opened the draft agenda for tonight's teleconference call, over the transom on my email came a request to be a friend by a total stranger named Ryan Hess, H-E-S-S, and I didn't know him from Adam, but something, you know, in the intuition, the gut instinct said, say yes, accept the friend. And I did, and that took me to his Facebook page. I clicked on it, and for a couple of years or so, maybe a little less than that, but about that, he had a project that he started some time ago to create what he calls the Museum of Conspiracy, and actually had a Kickstarter-type crowdfunding campaign for that. So I think Cheryl was trying to maybe get him on the call today, but it didn't happen for whatever reason. But I think that
I didn't reach out to him. I thought we could have him on a future one.
Oh, a future call. Okay, yeah. Okay. I misunderstood that from Ken's email to me as a follow-up. But anyway, so it's in the zeitgeist, and I think we could learn from the, you know, his experience and you know, not repeat the mistakes anyway by talking to Ryan Hess in the future. And I think it's a really great idea whose time has come. So that's in a nutshell.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, before we go to others, I'd like to I need to clarify that I had thought that Ryan was going to be on this call as well. I guess that's a miscommunication between Cheryl and me, so I'll have to take responsibility for that. But hopefully we can pursue this in the future and get him on to, you know, let us know about what he's been working with and see how it dovetails. And I'd also like to ask both Cheryl and Barbara, you know, what do you see as the kinds of exhibits that would physically be in this museum? I mean, I'm just looking for the kinds of items that one would expect to find there as opposed to the topics.
I could see having a lot of, you know, video stuff. Even in the 9/11 museum itself, they have a lot of mm-hmm. video as you walk through it. They have some... you know, they have pictures of the 19 hijackers and that kind of thing. We could put pictures of other people that we think are the real perpetrators. But they use a lot of video, and then they have on the walls explanations and stuff for people to read. And they have some of the, like, the big steel beams, but not too many because there weren't too many left. So they have some of those around. But basically theirs was more video kind of thing from what I can remember of it. I don't know, Barbara, you've been there also
I've been there. Opened it, and they had to throw me out at the end. I was there the whole time from like 8 to whatever it was, 8 or 9 p.m., and took photographs. And I have literally Richard Gage gave me his photographs from going in the museum and many other people, including my own. And the bottom line is, yes, the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero has lots of photographs, and they have lots of captions, you know, so-called explanations that push the official story. But they, what they have that we wouldn't have very many of, but we certainly would have some of, are physical objects, you know, the so-called artifacts from Ground Zero and from the Pentagon, and alleged from the Pentagon and Ground Zero. Anyway, they have these physical exhibit items. But we can, I have, and anyone can go in and get, but you don't need to because we already have them, really good high-resolution photographs of the exhibit items that they have that in our museum we can tell the truth in the captions about. So, and then I know that Steve White in New York City has more dust, you know. We could, I bet that Steve Jones would be willing to give a little vial maybe of dust, and if not, he got his in part from Steve Jones, one of more than one sample from Steve Jones from his windowsill near Ground Zero. So we could have that along with, of course, what's really been found in the dust and actual, you know, blow-ups of the red-gray chips and just all kinds of things we could have. And that's just in the 9/11 exhibit. We could really do an incredible job.
Right, right.
Okay, I'm going to put it into question. Unmute Barbara so she can also reply. There's a need. And I'd just like to make this comment that I'm you know, very favorable to this idea, especially since I heard you say, mentioned the idea, Cheryl, of a library. This name doesn't fall trippingly off the tongue, and it's not mentioned, it's not really suggested as a serious name for this project, but I think a alternative history library, museum, and research center is something that would encompass the entire idea of what you're looking at, that would draw in the most support, and could even potentially get academic support. I think that's a long shot, but I wouldn't rule it out. Okay, there just might be some university somewhere that might be willing to pony up and make it happen. I'm just that's wishful thinking, I suppose. But I just had to mention that in passing. Okay, so let's go to the questions here. Let's see who's first. Michael Cook.
Hey there. Yeah, I think it's a great idea, and I like the idea of doing it virtually and perhaps raising funds that way. If we ever do get to brick and mortar, I'd strongly urge searching diligently for an existing building rather than building one from scratch. You can generally, you know, find locations that would be a lot less expensive. And something I've been interested in doing for some time, and I haven't really gotten to yet, if anybody would like to join me in this, is putting together a video of all of the milestones that 9/11 Truth has made. A lot of people get discouraged and become inactive because, you know, they want the touchdown, and we haven't got the touchdown yet. But we have made a lot of yards, you know, going back to 2004 with David Ray Griffin's first book and all the big events that we have, you know, the milestones we've passed. But just putting that together in a video to kind of motivate and inspire and keep people going, I think would be a worthy endeavor. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mark. What's yours next? Barry?
Yeah, Barry in Toronto. This is wonderful news, wonderful initiative. And I was extremely pleased to hear Cheryl and Barbara how far they've advanced in their thinking and their research and the initiative. What I would throw in, for what it's worth, is that it would be good to be sure that this museum has an international aspect. I'm not sure it should be called the International Museum of whatever. I mean, false flags and 9/11 truth, that all has to be worked out. But, you know, right on the day of 9/11 in the Twin Towers, I think something like persons from 26 nationalities were killed that day, too. And so I think that might be kept in mind.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes things are unnecessarily America-centric. Another idea I have, that just pops into my mind is the extreme importance of false flag operations as a genre of historical deception. So I'm hearing that people are on that wavelength too. As far as physical objects are concerned, one that hasn't been mentioned, and there would be a lot of this, are posters and flyers and signs and banners. And I think various people, I remember like from the Vietnam War, anti-war protests, that a lot of people kept those banners and signs and so on. And they're really relevant historical artwork. So that can be called for when the train gets rolling here. The alternative history, that sure is important. Before the conference started, I just went to my own library, and I have more than 155 books myself about 9/11. I mean, those are the ones I just counted, and I know I have others. And I would think another idea, maybe this is my final one, is that some of us have gotten to the age where we're over 80, and the question of bequests comes in.
Yeah,
and I've
yeah.
been actually thinking a little bit about my books and, you know, where could I donate them, where, you know, put it in my will or whatever, where could I donate them where they would be appreciated? And I know books are a little bit old-fashioned, but not completely. And it would be wonderful if this museum is established, if the call went out especially for people who are planning their wills and their bequests and everything. It could also be for money to help to fund it and also to contribute resources.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be the ideas that came to me while I was listening.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Can you hear Cheryl and I still, Ken?
Yep. You're on mute.
Oh, you can? Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have a comment on Barry's. Really great suggestion. Just have everybody pray that the house I inherited from my mother sells soon, and we'll be able to fund this thing.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my.
Wow.
And I think Barry did make a good point. If we ask people, people might send anything they have related to 9/11.
Right.
Like that, so that would be great. Yeah.
Right.
I would like to mention also that I mentioned this in the call that I had earlier with Cheryl before this call, but I believe, I mean, could somebody tell us for sure, it's my understanding that there is an alternative JFK assassination museum, history museum in Dallas. Isn't that correct, that we could learn from their experience and have them so we don't reinvent the wheel there?
Does anybody know if that's the case or not? If you do, put yourself on the stack, please, and respond *6, because that would be interesting information if we could confirm that. Okay, and then let's see, go to the next one here. That would be somebody from Boston.
Hello, this is David Wold in Boston. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so first I want to say that everybody here at the Boston 9/11 Truth Group meeting in Boston, we all think this is an excellent idea. And then I actually got on to talk about the museum in Dallas. I know there was a conspiracy museum in Dallas that was founded by Robert B. Cutler, and I think it closed down in 2006. A friend of mine was his nephew, but we should definitely try to find out more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, see what we can learn from that.
Yeah,
I think they are. I think the resources are collected somewhere. So that's one thing I wanted to say. And then Richard Kushnick wanted to get on to talk about another idea.
Okay.
And could I just ask you who was just speaking?
That was David Rold, R-O-L-D-E.
Okay. Thanks.
One thing, the fellow who makes the 3D models of 9/11, the World Trade Center complex before and after, is right here in Arlington. And I just got my own little before and after small models. And as I recall the conversation I had with him, he said that 2 foot high models would cost, I think he said $2,000, but they're scalable just at the touch of a button on the computer, and so he could produce models of any size that we wanted, he would, I'm sure, be happy to do it at cost. So anyway, that's something that's certainly available. I also wanted to add, of course, I guess everyone knows about this. Anyway, there's no point in saying it probably. But, of course, given the repression that would undoubtedly confront us in attempting to establish or maintain such a museum, we would have to have total, absolute, and unquestionable control over the real estate. If we were renting, then we wouldn't last very long, so that would certainly have to be factored into the equation. And while our record here in the Boston group is not of coming up with large sums of money, we always do come up with something to support national initiatives and stuff like that, and so we'd, of course, be willing to do what we can to support it, and we love the idea.
Great. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Anyway, we have one more comment from Alan Rubin here, okay?
Okay, sure.
Just a comment about the 3D models. Since this person that's local here has already created a model of the before and after in software, so we already have the digitized model before and after that could be in the virtual museum. Without a lot of work, I think.
Great.
That makes sense?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I like the idea of the 3D models and that we could make it any height we wanted. It would be really interesting.
Hi, this is Al Magalota. I had a question as to where the most likely location would be for this museum, if anybody has any thoughts on that.
I gave that some thought, and I think that New York, since their museum is in New York, and tourists come in and they might go to that one and then say, well, let's go to the other one. I think we'd get the most amount of people visiting if we did that, but the real estate is really expensive there. So I don't know what others think, but that was my thought on that.
Yeah, it's an open controversial question and certainly one that people may wish to comment on. Anybody else from Boston have anything to say on this?
I think we're good here.
Okay, great.
Ken, this is Craig. Could I ask a quick one?
Well, wait a second, Craig. Let's get the stack done and then you and I can go because I'm
waiting. Okay, I didn't know we were still going into the stack. Okay.
Sure. There's two more left on the stack.
Yeah.
Okay, Frank?
Yeah, hi, here, Frank Telepko. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I was an active participant in the planning and execution of the 10th anniversary commemoration of 9/11 in Washington, D.C., overlooking the Pentagon. So, there, I want to play devil's advocate, but in a very positive way. Obviously, there are going to be a rule about the events at the Pentagon, but there are so many divergent viewpoints. How is that going to be handled?
Well, it has to be worked out. I think we should agree upon what we agree on and only put that in.
It doesn't seem there. That's easier, I think, said than done. It just doesn't apply to the Pentagon. It applies to many other viewpoints about the actual events of 9/11. We don't have all the facts or all the information, all the evidence there, and we may be putting ourselves out on a limb. And I think that's got to be faced before we jump ahead and see what we're going to actually put on display.
All right. Yeah, well, just to give you an example for the Pentagon, Frank, it remains to be seen. We could all vote on what we all agree on at some point, and outside the call as well. An example is, I think everyone in the movement agrees that Hani Hanjour and the hijackers weren't in control of whatever plane it was, whenever it was, at whatever point in the building it was. So there are points of major agreement. And I think that we can easily emphasize the points of agreement. And a museum, don't forget, is a work in progress. You can change the exhibits anytime you want.
Right, and we could have a room that was sort of the controversial room,
where
agreements were shared. And
yeah, there. I mean, because that's an accurate reflection of what's going on in the truth movement. Okay, there are some genuine controversies, and you just say here's this side, here's this side, and take it for what it's worth. At least both sides disagree with the official story. You see, that's the key. Right?
Well, you don't even need to give the conflicting theories of the evidence. You can just give the evidence that still needs to be explained.
Mm-hmm. There you
mm-hmm.
go. That's
yeah.
another approach. Okay. Thank you, and we'll go to the next questioner. That would be Jane Sufford.
Okay. I'm picking up on Barry's point about going where you're appreciated, and I think that while New York would be sort of an obvious choice because it's the locale of 9/11 and so forth. On the other hand, we should consider that everything is in New York, and it could be easily one more museum out of 642,000 could be easily overlooked, and maybe consider finding a place and maybe a smaller city that would really appreciate having us there and would advertise us, in their commercial, but their publicity for the city and so forth, and maybe become sort of a shrine for people that don't believe official stories and so on. We might think ahead to having sort of a small meeting or convention area there that would be available for people like us to meet and so on. And so while New York might be the best choice, on the other hand, we might do better. For instance, to give you an example, do you think that the National Baseball Museum, it'd be a good idea for them to pick up from Cooperstown to go to New York City? I don't think so, because that local town, local city, really advertises for them and goes to bat for them, and we need to find a place that would welcome us and announce our presence. Also,
no pun intended, right? Go to bat for them, no pun intended, right?
Yeah, right. That's a good one, yeah.
Barb, I've got a comment on that. On the upside of that, wherever you put a museum like this, and it's going to be more than a museum, as we've been discussing, with a museum as one of the focal points, just like at Ground Zero, it's not just a museum. But no matter where it ends up being, museums have traveling exhibits, and we can go everywhere with them. So that's number one. On the other side, however, it's hard to imagine. 9/11 was such a world transformative event, even more so than the JFK assassination. It's hard to imagine the JFK conspiracy museum anywhere but Dallas. And it's hard for me to imagine the museum, if we can afford the building and own the property, anywhere but New York City.
And James, I like your optimism that you think there might be a town that would welcome us. I mean, that would be great, but I don't know. Do you know some place that you think might do that?
Well, not for sure, but I would doubt that such a place might exist.
Maybe, yeah.
Times are hard. Boy, people are looking for ways to make money.
Well, that's true, too. But now, if we put a museum that talks about all kinds of false flags. I mean, 9/11 didn't just happen to New York. It happened to the whole world. It happened to all of us. And if we want to focus on just 9/11 New York, that's it. But if we want to make the point that there have been lots and lots of other false flags and lots of lies sold and so forth, maybe New York wouldn't be quite as obvious a place to do it.
Maybe we should put it in Nova Scotia, huh?
Well, I don't
know. Or
what about
Pearl Harbor? What about Pearl Harbor?
There you go.
Okay. that's a little bit distant,
okay.
But
maybe. Okay, James. So let me move on to the next person, okay?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, Boston, you got another one?
You can hear me?
Yep.
This is Rich again in Boston. I beg to differ with you, Barbara. The assassination of JFK and the coup d'etat that accompanied it was much more of a world transformative event than 9/11. It established in power the institutionalized, the deep state, many, many things happened of which, after that, which 9/11 is only one. I think that was the key world
Fair enough. Well, but let's try to stay on the subject of the museum. But thank you for that comment. Okay.
Point well taken.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, this is Gene LaRotonda from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you guys are aware, there's already a website called museumofconspiracy.com where somebody did start to already raise funds. They raised $1,700. They were looking for $15,000 to start something like this. It's quite an impressive site with the different exhibits.
That's the Ryan Hess website and Kickstarter that I mentioned earlier.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay, that's all I had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, everybody should go there. museumofconspiracy.org/.com? I forget.
.com.
.com, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah, thank you.
Before Craig asks his question, I'm just going to read from the Conspiracy Museum website that Dave Cole helpfully gave me the link for. The museum closed in December 30, 2006, having lost its lease. The building's owners announced that a Quiznos sandwich shop would take its place. Tom Bowden, the museum's president, said that the museum would relocate to another part of the Katy building or another location entirely, and that detailed plans would be released. But there's no further update from there on Wikipedia. So that's where things stood in 2006, okay? Okay, so Craig, you want to say something, and I'd like to also make a comment. Go ahead.
I think the question I was originally going to ask, Frank beat me to it. The question of sort of how would we agree on the content. I think obviously there does have to be some sort of a way of settling on things that everyone can agree to. I guess my only concern would be that we not end up sort of settling for the lowest kind of common denominator kind of thing. I would hope that if we did a section on the Pentagon that there would be more than Hani Honjer's, suspiciousness mentioned. But I always like the way David Ray Griffin does it in his books. You know, he just kind of takes each piece of evidence and kind of dissects it, using verifiable facts. And so really what he's, you know, the way I guess I see it is he's basically taking the official story and he's taking each element of the official story and he's putting it to the test to see whether it stands up to scrutiny. And I think that is stronger than simply saying, well, let's eliminate anything we disagree on. I think that would be could be problematic. But anyway, because I mean, it wouldn't just be 9/11. There could be disagreements about all kinds of different events. But I guess we have to find some way that we don't water everything down in order to avoid, you know, offending everybody. So I guess that's more of a comment. But I'd certainly like to hear what you guys think.
Yeah, well, I was just mentioning Connie Hunter as an example, of course.
Yeah, no, I know, and yeah. And it's worth mentioning for sure, but
yeah.
And as I see it, Craig, I think we would have to have some kind of a committee to get this started, and then you know that would have to be worked out because that is that is an issue, and we don't want to water it down, and no, so we'd have to work that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Craig, and. My comment is just that I want to focus on, you know, how people are talking about the importance of owning the property and all that. You know, I think that is a key because I don't know how many of you are aware that Amazon.com has started with what we're in the alternative movement calling book burning, okay, where they're excising titles from their list based on political content. This was just started a few weeks ago by Mr. Bezos, but the idea of having a library of our materials, our alternative materials, that was secure, that no matter what they do elsewhere regarding information suppression, is going to stand the test of time because it's physically there and we can control that property, I think has a certain selling quality. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I like. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I think we would need to have security. We'd need to have, you know, own the place and have a lot of security cameras. You know, the whole thing and guarding it. So, and that will cost money, but that we can't do it any other way, really. So.
Yeah, there's a project that we could be doing right now, that is simple. And that is, I learned, as it happened, my book, October Surprise, I actually received an invitation. I'd have to go back. I've got it in my computer, the precise name. But Google has a project to make an international library of all books that have ever been. And all you have to do is submit the book, the physical book, and then they scan it, and it's in their library. So we should be doing this, if Barry's still on, for sure, with all 160 of your books. And maybe we can all of us go through our libraries and make a list, an alphabetical list, leaving off the word the or a, an alphabetical list of the titles of the 9/11 and 9/11-related books we have. And we could have a very important and simple project to get these to this Google project.
Mm-hmm. Any volunteers to do that?
Well, the first step is for each of us, if we're willing, to make that alphabetical list of the books that we have, and then we can eliminate duplicates, and we'll start a master list.
Who's going to keep the master list? That takes a volunteer. You volunteering, Barb?
No, I have too much on my plate right now. I wish I could.
Yeah. Okay, well, the idea is out there. If anybody wants to volunteer to pick it up, then run with it. So,
Barbara, can you send us like an email or a link to where we can find out about that Google project? And
yeah, I'll do my best to find it. And the problem is always, what did I call it when I saved it? But right. I'll try.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, Cheryl and Barb, thank you for your...
No, I think Barry has another call. There's a few people who have questions.
Oh, are there some more people?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought we were done. Go ahead.
Barry, can you get... There's two people. Are you looking at it?
Hang on.
Okay, I just did it.
I thought we...
Oh, yeah. I think... I think I've gotten through here. You know, to have differences of opinion about what is historical fact is just the everyday work of museum boards and directors. So that if they're on the board that there should be for this museum, there should be a good representation, one, two, at least possibly three museum curators. I'll bet that you could find volunteers. And they're veterans at taking into account the different interpretations of whatever it is that has happened. And I think that these discussions, which are valuable and interesting, that are being held, you know, heard here tonight, should be deferred until the composition of the board is set. And there certainly should be museum veterans and experts on the board. That, I would think that's a must.
Okay. Do anybody want to comment on that? Or Cheryl,
I just wanted to ask
pardon?
If anyone, does anyone know anybody who works in a museum who might want to, or who's a 9/11 or supporter?
Yeah. If you know anybody like that, please get on the stack and let us know, okay? Okay, so we'll go to James. James, go ahead.
Okay, I'd just like to say that I can volunteer the website that I superintend, 911grassroots.org, which is an official 9/11 Truth website, to archive the list of books that people provide.
So people could send you if they wanted to itemize their library and send you the titles.
Yeah, just send me the titles and I'll add them. I'll maintain and add to a list.
Oh, fantastic! Great. Okay, so we got a volunteer.
That can be accessed by anyone.
Okay. Well,
that's great. We'll do that. Thank you so much.
Sure. To go in the minutes for sure. Okay, Craig.
Comment. I have a comment on everybody's comments, but I think everybody, and that is when I did the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour, what I learned, and it was almost like doing a museum, even though it was based upon a physical museum and responding to its claims and its exhibit items, what I learned was that if you simply make a list as we're developing this project of the physical exhibit items, of the photographs of their physical exhibit items, of the dust samples, of the photographs, of the placards, whatever, that what you do with the museum really revolves around those physical things. That's the nature of a museum. And, of course, you can have books and videos and all of that you can click like you do in the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero. But a lot of this depends upon what you decide you want to physically put in the museum and the virtual version also.
And maybe, Barbara, you know, I like your suggestion if we do the virtual version first and then we have all of everything together and then we can be fundraising all the while we're doing that to have the brick-and-mortar one, we'll be really organized with it before.
Absolutely. You do all the content work to do the virtual one while you're raising funds, however you do, for your bricks-and-mortar venue. The other thing, let's see, was something else I wanted to mention. It's probably slipped my mind now. That's a major point, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Thank you for James. Michael, you wanted to say something else?
Hey there.
Michael,
yeah, Mike Cook here. I just wanted to say I do know a museum curator. I don't know if he would get on board with this or not. His name is Edmund February. I met him through my climbing. We climbed together for a few months. And he was curator of the South African Museum for quite a while, and I reached out to him about 9/11, and I stopped hearing back from him, which is frequently the case.
But that was quite a number of years ago, and it's worthwhile, I think, trying to reach out to people again and again.
Sure.
I always like to bring up the fact that somebody had to pester David Ray Griffin for 2 years before he would look into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll reach out to him again, see if I can locate him, see what kind of response he gives us. And as an alternative to New York, Washington, D.C. would be worthy of consideration.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Comments, Cheryl?
That's a good idea. And I also just remembered, I know a guy in New York who's an architect, and he did the Picasso Museum in Spain, and he's right there, and I know him pretty well, so that's another option of somebody who might help us with the whole thing. So, yeah,
okay.
These are all great ideas, and I think, what are the next steps? What do you see as the next steps? What do we do?
Well, one thing is we definitely want to have that fellow, we're talking about Ryan, on our next call to pursue this and see what he has to say. Okay, so that we'll just list this as one of our items of continual concern, so that it doesn't need to be agendized if there's anything to update on it or to pursue with it. But if you do want to do anything particular with it, you know, let me know so we reserve time on it, okay?
Okay, I agree.
Yeah,
I think that's good. I think if we really wanted to move forward, we need to get some kind of a committee together to get this off the ground. So if anyone's thinking they might be interested in that, I guess let us know. Think about
Let Cheryl know. Okay, Cheryl will be the point person for the moment on this.
Yeah, I've already agreed to do that, Ms. Barb.
Okay.
Okay.
Let Cheryl know personally if you by email or whatever that you're interested in helping to organize this project. Okay. Because it's certainly one that certainly has garnered some quick enthusiasm, and so we have to suppose that others in the truth movement would be just as quick to recognize the value of it.
It's Barb. I remember what I was going to tell you. It's important.
Yeah.
In the process of creating the 9/11 Museum Virtual Walking Tour, I went through physically more than just the 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero at Infinitum, as well as taking photographs and copious notes. And one of them was the Smithsonian Museum of American History. Basically, we're talking about a history museum here in a way. And the interesting thing at the Smithsonian Museum of American History, and I think it would be a good idea to seriously consider doing it in this museum, both the virtual one and hopefully a bricks and mortars version later, built on the content of the virtual one as it evolves. There's noise on the line, so I'll wait a sec. Okay. But what you do in what they force you to do once you get your ticket and you go into the history of American wars, I'm giving you an example, they force you to go through a chronological sequence, okay? So you start with the Revolutionary War or the American Indian Wars, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War and World War I, World War II, Vietnam War, blah, 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 Korean War. And you get up and they actually have a 9/11 section, folks, okay? Because then that gets into what they call the War on Terror. You can guide people through the order in which you want people to become educated in the museum. And, of course, we want to educate people that this is one of a long history of American false flags. And not only that, Kevin Barrett's brilliant presentation on the history of false flags going back to Nero, really.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point, Barbara. That's really we could do a lot with this. We could really have an impact, I think. It would be.
I think so.
Yeah.
Especially with traveling exhibits from the museum.
Mm.
I guess that's it for our questioners.
No,
again.
Ken, there's somebody else who has a question?
No, I think that was...
The Boston?
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Boston.com. Okay. Go ahead, Boston.
This is Richard Kleschnick. I probably won't be worth very much, but I would be happy to be on the committee.
Oh, great.
Also, I'd like to be added back onto the list for this call. I frequently miss three calls until I get bumped off the list, but I'd like you to put me back on again.
Can you email me, Richard, on that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Please just email me, and I'll make sure we get you separately on the list, okay?
All righty.
Okay. Okay. Is that it, Cheryl, or do we have more?
No, I think that's it.
That's it. Okay.
Ken,
well, thank you again.
For the minutes, did we want to include anyone's email? Like you said, contact Cheryl or Barbara. Do either or both want their emails in the minutes?
I think for simplicity, we should say Cheryl for now. Okay. Even though Barbara is,
okay.
Yeah, I don't. I don't need mine. I don't even. Cheryl will give us a summary of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay. Cheryl,
is that okay to put your email?
That's fine with
yeah.
me. Yep, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, James for the James, it's okay to give your email out, right, for people to send their itemized library to. Oh, sorry, James is muted. He can't answer. Hang on. Well, here, let's just take it off of
Okay, I just wanted to say that once a list of books gets started, anybody can check the list, and that way they can delete the duplications from their list and just see if there's anything that they have that isn't already on the list to add.
But wait a minute, James. I thought the reason people were doing this was for the potential of donation. So I don't think it hurts to know that there are more than one person willing to consider donating to this project.
Well,
okay.
Another way to do it would be I can put a number after it, you know, like
mm-hmm.
if there's 23
yeah.
copies available,
yeah.
I can put 23
like
after
that.
It or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
I think that
great.
would be helpful, yeah. Okay.
James,
okay.
Can you give us your website where you'll be posting this, please?
Sure, 911grassroots.org.
Okay, thanks.
And you're going to have to give me a little bit of time to figure out how to, you know, obviously and easily list it there, but I'll take care of that.
It's okay to list your email in the minutes, right, for people to send their list to, right?
Absolutely, and I encourage you to check out my website. I think you'll like it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, all right. I guess we're done finally with this issue. And thanks again, Cheryl and Barbara, for the inspiring idea. And let's hope that it gets some legs. Okay.
Okay.
Announcements. Anybody got any announcements?
I have one.
Go ahead.
I do too on JASTA, the JASTA cases.
Okay.
My announcement is that I received confirmation today that my book, Colonel Crystal's Parallel Universe, is scheduled for publication by Train Day Publishers next spring, just a year from now.
Can you give us just a thumbnail sketch of what the book's about?
Well, it's about this top flight commander, Colonel Alva A. Crystal, a fictitious character, made-up person, who retired early from the Afghanistan and Iraq wars because a commanding general of his set him straight on a lot of things, and he got thinking, and he retired to a secluded spot on the Florida coast. Swampy part of the coast, and he put together his thoughts, and he ended up he had this great idea for a defense only military that wouldn't be involved in foreign adventures, but would be based in the United States, that would be plenty strong to protect the country, and that would be its only mission. And he went on radio stations, radio programs all over, and touted his idea. And what became of him for becoming a
a very credible dissident doing that, what the Pentagon did to him. So that's what it's about.
And this is fiction, right?
Yeah, it's fiction. It's fiction, but it's totally fact-based.
That's the best kind.
That's the best kind.
Okay. All right. Thank you, James. And Barbara?
I've got an announcement, very exciting announcement. I don't have too many details, but there are two cases. I will send the either the links or the text. I'm not sure I have the links to all of them, but there have been recent articles about two cases that are moving forward with 9/11 victims' family members, two separate groups of 9/11 victims' family members, the original Motley Rice lawsuit with 900 or so 9/11 victims' family members, and now a separate one, which I think has about 400. But they are moving forward now that JASTA has passed, the 28 pages were released, and JASTA has passed. So that's really good news. And also I'll send another article, I believe it was from the Wall Street Journal. I have the link for that one. I got it online on Google after reading the hard copy version in the Wall Street Journal. And it's basically, you know, about the Saudis putting pressure on and hoping that JASTA will either be watered down or overturned now that Trump is in office. However, the analysis is that that's extremely unlikely to happen and that Trump was a major supporter of the release of the passage of JASTA, at least when he was a candidate for the presidency. So I'll send all those, and it's really good news.
Okay. All right. Anybody else with an announcement? Wait a minute. Some people are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some people are muted.
Well, they're self-muted, I guess, because question and answer session's over. Oh no! It's not. Now it's over. Anybody else have an announcement? Anybody else have an announcement?
This is Mike Cook.
Yeah, Mike.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, here in Cincinnati, there's an exhibit called 9/11 Steel, where they have some structural steel from the World Trade Center, and they're doing a fundraiser with it this Sunday. It's going to be a country music marathon. One of the big Nashville singers, female, is going to be there, and she's also doing the the national anthem at opening day for the Cincinnati Reds, which is like a local holiday. And I'm trying to get people to go out there with me. So far, it looks like it's just me and another guy. He was maybe going to pony up the money to actually have a table if they would give us one. But I have called him a couple times today, tried to get him on this call, haven't heard back, not sure what's up with him and the whole thing. A couple of people I've approached have things to do and can't make it. But
could you clarify for us what this event is? It's not a 9/11 event itself, is it?
No, it's a official 9/11 event, not a 9/11 truth event. The city of Cincinnati was the first municipality to institute a fire department. And so it's, you know, one of our claims to fame. We've got the first fire department and also the first baseball team was Cincinnati Reds, professional, right? And they have this piece of steel at the Fire Museum here in Cincinnati. That they're in charge of it, but it travels the country. And it raises money for when they have the events. The funds go to firefighters and cops and first responders and such. Whatever, I don't know all the details about it, but if you get on Facebook and you look up 9/11 Steel Cincinnati, you'll find the event. And I'm hoping I'll come up with some folks. It's this Sunday, April 2nd, coming right up. So hopefully we'll be able to make something happen for it and have a truth presence there, even if it's just us walking around in our T-shirts trying to pass out flyers and DVDs. We might actually have a table, though. It remains to be seen.
Good luck on that, Mike. Okay, does anybody else have an announcement?
James had mentioned an upcoming event in D.C. that he might want to alert people to, for especially anybody in the D.C. area. It sounded pretty good. You want to talk about that, James, real quick?
It's just what was in the email, and I don't have it right in front of me,
so I really can't. Okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll
have to. But it's available to anybody on the listserv, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, I know what it probably is. This is Barb. Les Jameson sent an email to the effect that there's going to be a big science march, I believe, sometime in April.
No.
You'd have to
Google.
And they're pulling together a 9/11 truth presence for that. It's very important.
That's interesting, but no, that's not what it was. This was some kind of a conference on alternative history, basically, but using some incredibly mainstream sources, which is fascinating.
Just a minute, I may be able to find it. Here.
Okay. Yeah, see if you can find it. Okay, in the meantime, does anybody else have any announcements?
Okay.
Well, it's Barb again. I do know that Andrew Krieg recently held such a conference in Washington, D.C.
Okay, this email is put out by the sponsor. It says an unbelievably great upcoming conference. It's the National Security State and JFK.
Yeah, that's Andrew Krieg's conference.
June 3rd.
So this passed?
It's put out by Jacob D. Hornberger.
Oh, no, that's a similar title, different conference.
Yeah, not a similar name, though. I don't know. Mm-hmm. National Security State and JFK. Maybe the same one. Who knows?
And what's the date on it, James?
June 3rd.
Okay.
And it costs, let's see, it costs $99, including coffee and tea, lunch and appetizer break. And speaker lineup will be absolutely blow your socks off.
Yeah.
And anybody on the list or got it today.
Yeah. It includes Ron Paul and Oliver Stone, just to mention a couple of notable names that are involved.
Yeah. A number of newspaper journalists from mainstream newspapers, you know, big mainstream newspapers, which is fascinating. I mean, that's what makes this interesting more than anything, is the mainstream contributors.
Says here, Peter Janney, author of Mary's Mosaic, the CIA conspiracy murder John F. Kennedy.
Yep. But there's some other journalists that are speaking as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds
okay.
Great.
So,
I would attend
if you're in the D.C.
nearby.
Area, you might want to check that out. Okay. Any other announcements?
Yes, this is Cheryl. I just have one. Kat McGuire and I are putting on 5 panels, maybe 6, at the Left Forum again this year. And unfortunately, the date is June 2nd through the 4th, so it kind of conflicts with that one in Washington. But we're going to have a panel on 9/11/101, which is going to have Barbara's going to be on it, Richard Gage and Kevin Barrett. We have one on thought crimes where Anthony Hall and Jeremy Rothkuschel will be on it with Kevin Barrett. We're doing one on the global war on terror, false flags, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the other one right now. My brain's dead at this point. But we'll have more information on that pretty soon coming out.
And hopefully they'll be videoed and put on.
They are. Alan Reese of No Lies Radio is already.
Reese, yeah.
He's going to be videoing, so it'll be good. Yeah.
Cool.
And it will also be live streamed also. By No Light
Radio. Wow.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Incredible. That's good. Well, I'm going to keep subscribing. I'm going to keep my subscription up with the world with No Light Radio then so I can tune into that. Okay. Any other announcements? Okay. Well, then it sounds like we're done for tonight. We'll see you all next month when Peter Ketchum will be our guest speaker, and he's already talked a little bit about what he's going to be talking about. So we'll see you then. Have a good month, and we'll see you at the end of the month. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye. Hey, if Barbara Honegger is still on there, would you accept my friend request on Facebook?
I think she's gone already.
She's
gone. All right. Have a good night, guys.
Okay. Thanks, Gene. Bye.
All right.
Yep.
Are we can you unrecord it?
Oh, thank you. Oh, my gosh.